Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we'll be talking about in this episode are the top 300 trade sales through Diamond for March 2019. Actually, we've got the top 500, but typically when we do month-to-month, we may limit that to 300 just because we've got that going back a lot further. This is what's sold into retail stores predominantly in North America. It is not what they have sold to us. I'd love to have that point of sales information, but it's just not available. And is unlikely to ever be just because of the nature of the direct market, which is a bunch of small individual retailers for the most part. Yeah, there's some chains and stuff, but there's just so many individual companies that we'd have to deal with to go get that, which is actually a nice problem to have. It's unusual for that kind of retail market, particularly in the United States, to still exist. Mm-hmm. But with that means, you know, no point of sales information. So we're going to deal with the numbers we have, as we always have. If we look at the breakdown of the top 300 trade sales through Diamond, 44.1% went to Image, 19.99% went to Marvel, and 17.14% went to DC. So that right there between those three publishers is accounting for 81.24% of the total units for the top 300 trades. And we've got another, 21 publishers here on the list in the top 300. So some of them like Dark Horse, 4.81%. Others such as really the last three that each had an item on the list, like Valiant, Yen Press, and NBM, they account for 0.11% of the total units for the top 300 trades. And they had one item, and it was selling between, 356 units for Valiant, 354 for Yen Press, and 344 for NBM. So, you know, a single item, not going to get you very far on the list, from a smaller publisher. If it's from a major publisher, it could. Matter of fact, one of the things that could top the list, it could actually get you into the fourth or fifth largest publisher on the list if that's all you had. Of course. The irony with that is, if that's all you had and it sold that well, odds are you're not a small publisher. You're, you know, probably Image at that point.
Yeah.
I think we've seen one or two things from DC or Marvel over the years do really well on the trade list, but generally speaking, the stuff that's selling that well, it's usually Image.
Makes sense. You know, those creators have kind of, at least the ones that we see at the top of the list, they've really established their core audience and obviously, you know, market most of their books to those group of people.
Well, and I think the key thing there is they market their stuff to that group of people, not the company. And I think that's a key difference between how Image works versus how Marvel, DC, and most of the other publishers work. Those publishers have, you know, people that are designated to, okay, go promote these books. It's not the creators themselves. And I think because the creators themselves are having to do that kind of hustle and stuff over at Image, they've got a much more vested interest in the effectiveness in the marketing and promotion and such. And I think that sometimes pays off with spades. Other times, not so much, because you may be a great creator, doesn't mean you're a great promoter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we talk all the time about artists in general love to make the art. They don't necessarily like the business side of the art and having to push the product, having to get out and make sure people are aware of it, or having to know which channels to really focus their efforts on, you know, because it's obviously in a lot of ways a different skill set. We obviously see a lot of creators that are successful at it, but maybe that's because it's almost like a self-selecting thing. We only see the people that are successful at it because the other people are kind of below the radar.
Well, I think creating content and marketing content are very, very different skill sets. I say that as somebody who's been producing a podcast for, 11, 12 years now. And I think I'm decent at creating the content. I think I could be way better at marketing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think you're right. There is a certain self-selection of, we tend to notice the items at the top of the list a lot more than those at the bottom. And that means they've successfully promoted the stuff. So it's one of those things that every once in a while there's some properties that just come out of nowhere and do gangbusters, or there's some stuff that it's just, it's really good. Everybody who reads it loves it, but just not many people read it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny because, I mean, this time of year we've seen is when we see the Eisner nominations come out. And I glanced at the one this year. I didn't look in too much detail, but I think that's a great case study on things that are, right or wrong, perceived to be some of the best material out there, but often some of the most obscure material.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not always. I think they've got, you know, Tom King and Batman and a couple of things this time around. But generally, I go through the list, and out of the couple of items, you know, the four or five in each category, it, you know, and I've actually, you know, seen the ballots and stuff before and been involved a little in that process tangentially and stuff. You know, voting on that, I think, is, for somebody like me, almost a fool's errand, because I would wind up voting for the item I have heard of. You know, unlike the judges, of course, who get to actually see all the material firsthand, spend a weekend together and review it. Because sometimes just chasing down copies of that stuff is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So I always wonder if that really is the best of the best. And if it is, what does that say about the market where you just can't find the really good stuff? But what we're looking at is here is sales, not perceived quality or whatever. And of course, that's a slippery slope because everyone perceives that differently.
Absolutely.
If we jump over to the list itself, topping the list this time by a fairly decent margin is Walking Dead Volume 31 with 11,701 units. Now that's about a little over 25% below where the previous volume has ended up sales-wise. Of course, it's had time for some reorder activity. It's not uncommon when, matter of fact, I'd say it's very common when Walking Dead comes out for it to top the list with a new volume.
Mm-hmm.
If we filter the list to Walking Dead, we'll see a number of the other volumes on the list, but not all of them. At one point, we would usually see all of them, but at this point, we've got a number of the compendiums and such, but the trade paperback volumes themselves are still basically following that V formation we've talked about a number of times, where the most recent and the first volume tend to be the highest sellers, followed by the second most recent in the second volume, the third most recent in the third volume, etc., until you hit kind of that inflection point where the people who are catching up on getting current, you know, on that kind of tail end of stuff versus those who are starting out and reading it and stuff, there's a point at which you kind of hit that equilibrium or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this point, we've only got the first eight volumes on the list, and then from volumes 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, and, of course, 31, which is the new volume. So there's about, what, two-thirds of the material, actually, closer to half, I guess, half the material that's not even on the list this time. And that's more or less the middle half.
Mm-hmm.
But that's to be expected, particularly when you've got a series that's been going on this long.
Yeah, I mean, getting up to 31 volumes, and that's only speaking about these, you know, six-issue trade paperbacks, not even the other versions of it you can get. That's quite a bit of catalog. And I, you know, just from my experience, I've talked in the past about how my retailer has an entire little stand that's just Walking Dead. So some of it, maybe people have enough copies in the store.
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of stores know to carry it and they have ordered it. And when they reorder, they're going to do it in incremental amounts, not, you know, all at once or something across the nation. And I think also when you get this many volumes, as good a word of mouth as the series had, I've got to think it's got to be a little bit more daunting for a new reader. I mean, if it's, oh, it's six volumes, yeah, I'll pick up the first. It's 31 volumes. Well, do I want to make that kind of a commitment? If I like the first, I'm committing kind of sort of to 30 more volumes.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's also almost uncharted territory in some respects, because I would be hard-pressed to name any other kind of non-manga that has 30 plus volumes within a single kind of story continuity.
Mm-hmm.
For a single title, at least. Obviously, Marvel, DC, they've got a lot of things within, you know, a single continuity. Yeah. It's just not one story.
And I would bring up something like Spawn, but he doesn't keep all that stuff in print all the time. And then, you know, obviously they've had, like, even though they kept the number the same, he's had, you know, somewhat story reboot kind of things going on. So,
I mean, there are other titles that are as almost roughly as long lasting, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less.
Uh-huh.
Spawn, Savage Dragon, Invincible comes to mind, but that's also Kirkman.
Mm-hmm.
Man, beyond that, I'd have to give it some thought.
Yeah, I mean, there's the Fred Perry Gold Digger, but I mean, that's really niche. You know what I mean?
That's true. Antarctic Press has been doing a couple of things, like Gold Digger and Ninja High School and a few other things, Forever in a Day.
Mm-hmm. But you're right. It's probably under 8 that you could probably come up with.
And even that, I think if we ran those 8 by the listener base, I'm sure a lot of them would be like, again, Gold Digger from Fred Perry and stuff. They're probably, a lot of people are unaware of that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would expect 99% of the comic buying public to be unaware of Gold Digger, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it because I've seen Antarctic Press at Comic-Con every year for, again, Forever and a Day. And they're you know, figuratively speaking, just down the street. I mean, they're in San Antonio. I'm here in Austin. But still, they're within arm's reach if I really wanted to go there. And good publisher. And again, one of the longer lasting ones, but also kind of under that radar for a lot of people. Matter of fact, I would be hard-pressed to name the last time they showed up on the breakdown on either the trade or the comic side. I'm sure they have. I just, again, don't remember when.
Yeah. They may be one of those people that flies kind of under the 300, the top 300 radar. If they might show up on the year-end list, you know, that slow aggregate over the whole course of the year. They still obviously would be pretty low, but... you know, obviously they keep publishing, so I'm assuming they have some sort of dedicated fans that buy their material.
They seem to do decent at conventions and stuff like that. I think they definitely have their fan base, but it's one of those things that I think a lot of publishers in that kind of size, i.e. smaller but still very viable, which is good, because I think there's a need for a little bit more of these niche publishers, because they can fill needs that the big publishers, frankly, don't and aren't going to bother with.
Mm-hmm.
And if that gets people into the store because they really like, be it Ninja High School, Gold Digger, or whatever, and then they stick around, buy a few other things, that's good for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the second item on the list is Detective Comics 80 Years of Batman Deluxe Edition Hardcover, 8,986 units. This, to me, is a little bit of a I don't want to say an oddball or whatever, in so much as it's a little different than a lot of other stuff, because the only other thing I would really say is like it would be the Action Comics one they did a little while ago.
What's the sales comparison to that? How well did that sell?
That's a great question. I would have to go look that up. Give me just a second and I will do that. Okay. But these kinds of almost, I don't say anniversary things, but you know what I mean? It's, celebrations of long-runningness. How about that?
Yeah, for sure. One thing I did want to highlight is on the actual, like, total, like, you know, item numbers for the you know, the three ones we don't normally look at the top of the charts, Image, Marvel, and DC. This was an extremely heavy reorder month for Image. So they had a total of 106 items in the trade section. Marvel had a total of 67 and DC a total of 34. So, you know, they almost, you know, three times as many releases as DC and almost twice as much as Marvel. And 91 of those 106 for Image were reorder. Only 15 of them were new. So it was quite a big amount of reorder. And then when I was looking at the actual breakdown, I'm almost wondering if they did some discounting to kind of, you know, as offered the retailers a good selection of sales or something. But it's hard for me to tell with the retail rank because the stuff at the top is at $9.99 trade. So I don't know if those retail ranks are distorted enough to tell me if that's an actual sale or if it's just what the retail rank would be for $9.99 collections.
I think it's a bit of a sale because if you jump down to rank number 8, which is the $9.99 Super Sons new material, the Project Polar Shield, the DC Zoom, the kids thing, from DC, it has a higher retail rank than either Saga or Monstrous, both of which, again, are the $9.99 things from Image.
Gotcha.
So that implies those were discounted a bit more than the DC thing.
Gotcha. So it might be one of those things where they say, you know, if you order a certain amount, we'll give you an extra 10% off or something. Or if you order a minimum amount, like, you know, some cutoff, like 30 to 60 volumes of something, you know, we give you extra. Because it looks 91 reorders is pretty big month.
It is. And I think there's an aspect of possibly also with Image, them realizing if they get those first volumes out there, they're going to do better on all the subsequent ones. So it may be a little bit of a lost leader sort of a thing. I don't know.
Well, and to be honest with you, from Image's perspective, you know, that's where I think more and more of the money is going to be made, because you just see, I know you talk about on the single issue side, the average single issue numbers, you know, just continue to trend down. Obviously, so many reboots, it's sometimes hard to see, but I know that you guys talk about just trying to see how many titles can stay in the 50,000 or 30,000 range. You know, for obvious, some titles, you just don't expect them to have an audience for something more than 30,000, you know, after the first two or three issues where you have those big drop-offs from variants or first launches. But, you know, just those certain bands which you consider healthy sales, sustainable sales, and you just see fewer and fewer comics falling to that. We've seen in the past where Marvel, once something fell below 20,000, they would automatically cancel it, and that's long gone. They let things drop far further. So there's just slow erosion of titles selling average less.
Yeah.
So I think a big chunk of the money now, at least, you know, for profitability, special at Image, is in the collected edition. So, you know, I think you're right. Maybe getting those first trades out gets people's hooked, brings them back for the second or third if the particular series has that much material. And that's really where they can, you know, make the money.
Well, and that's something I wanted to talk about. Real quick, let me jump back to answering your previous question about Action Comics. That 80-year one did initially 18,641 units with another 1,200 units of reorder activity.
Do you mean 18,000?
Yeah.
Wow, so that's 10,000 more than this one, basically?
That's what I'm reading, and yeah, I'm double-checking, because you're right. The 1,000 thing is usually a slip of the tongue when I do it on this side.
And
it's 18,000.
Yeah. And, you know, the honest truth is, it's interesting because I would expect Batman to sell a little bit better than Superman, but this is technically Detective Comics, and technically, like, there is, like, a lot of nostalgia for, like, Superman Action Comics kind of thing. So,
yeah.
It's interesting, though.
Yeah, I would not have necessarily pegged that of having been the higher one, because typically, you're right, it's everyone's argument is, oh, well, it's Batman. Batman's always going to sell better.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much in this case.
And to be honest, wasn't the reviews for the Superman Man much more positive than the reviews for this detective, right?
Yes. It was for the 1,000 issue, yeah.
Right.
I haven't actually read or even cracked open either of the 80-year ones.
Okay, that's right. This is kind of more of a compilation of previous material. So yeah. I want to make that statement, but yeah. Okay.
But again, going back to the effectively what we're saying is trades, that's where the money is. You can kind of have that long tail effect or whatever. The question I've got on that is, because I was thinking about it a little this morning before we started recording, on how to a certain degree, I think you could argue that the trade paperback is really the native format that they're telling the story for.
Oh, yeah. And they're subsidizing it with the issues, basically.
Yeah, they're serializing it out into the component issues just as a way to kind of get some of the money in. But that's not the initial intent of the story, even if that is the initial publication of the story.
Well, and hedging the risk and things like that. And then the honest truth is, it may be a better statement to say the trades are where the profit lie that enable the series to continue. You know what I mean? Because, you know, if you look at the Jim Zub posts on his creator-owned stuff, and you've talked in a previous episodes about how, you know, you'll read the back matter of certain Image series and they say, oh, we're hoping to get to issue 4 to judge if there's more demand, you know, for it, or, you know,
yeah,
and maybe finish this 4 issue run up and then we'll see if there's more. So it is, you know, it's a balance. Let's put it that way.
Well, I did a little research this morning. Again, going on the theory that they tend to be telling 5-6 issue arcs across the board from all the publishers, and you can get it in trade, and, you know, kind of that. Because at one point I was thinking, well, the trade's going to take over as the primary revenue stream, and it never did. But it seems to have taken over in terms of the major story length and format. So I said, okay, I'm going to pick a property, and I'll tell you in a sec which one, and see. How does that do? Because if the trade is really where that money is, and I think certainly for creator-owned stuff and all of that, I definitely think it is. And I think, like, Zub's mentality and stuff, perfectly right on the money and stuff. Creator-owned versus corporate-owned may play out differently. I picked a corporate-owned one because I wanted to, in theory, stack the deck in favor of the, well, I guess trades do have this kind of longer life. Because the idea would be if we took something from Marvel or DC, a known commodity, and if the money really is in the trade, and we've got a lot of reorder activity this time, as you've already pointed out, then shouldn't it make sense that since everything's getting collected, these things will just show up over time on the list repeatedly, and maybe it won't be as obvious from month to month, but if you take this step back and say, well, show me the history of this property in trade, it does surprisingly well. So I said, okay, how can I stack the deck in favor of this? Because I wanted to be charitable for whatever purposes. It's so unlike me. And I said, okay, let's try to find something where over, say, the last decade, there's a reason to think that there is an actual increased awareness and interest in the character. So there's a not just some obscure thing, well, you know, sure, Batgirl, who cares about Batgirl? Or, you know, something where people couldn't just discount the findings based on, well, you picked the wrong thing. So I said, what is arguably, maybe not the highest profile character, but one that's had an increase in profile specifically over the last decade or so? So I went with Iron Man, figuring he's kind of maybe not the linchpin character of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but a key character there. And I think you could argue he is the linchpin character. So I looked at the trade history I've got, and again, I've got this going back to 2003. Now, keep in mind, back then I had the top 10, then the top 25, then the top 50, then top 100, top 300, now the top 500. So further back, it diminishes the number of hits I can get. But even so, they've been producing Iron Man at a steady pace, sometimes more than, you know, a title a month. And out of all of these, yeah, I could find, you know, obviously every trade show up on the list, or at least every trade that was on the list showed up on the list, so maybe that's self-defeating. But the point is, I found out of all the trades that I got, none of them showed up on the list more than, I think, five times. And it kind of goes against the, well, people are waiting for the trade, they'll get it, it's a slow seller, whatever. And maybe it's, if I looked at the year-end stuff, maybe that would change stuff. I didn't do that. But it really shows how a character that, just in the Marvel Universe, comic-wise, is a major character. I think in the cinematic stuff, it elevated the character's status in the mass audience. There's not really any particular strength in longevity of any particular trade in terms of continued demand. I went ahead and also charted the sales of the main Iron Man titles over the last, you know, 15, 16 years, whatever, and did not particularly see any uptick in sales at all corresponding with the time frame where he's been in the movies, which again, I had pretty much expected. It's not one of those where if you liked a particular Iron Man movie that there's always a particular trade or series of issues to go back to. But when we've got creators like Jim Zub, and let me be clear, I absolutely believe him when he says the money is there in the trades for him. Get the material out. At some point, that goes kind of in a loss position, but the trades make up for it. Completely believe him, and I don't think that's unique to him, but I think there's an aspect where, again, creator-owned works one way, and on the corporate side here, they pump, and part of it is they pump so much out. Because we actually did have an Iron Man item or two on the list. Now, one thing I did do when I went through and pulled the Iron Man stuff, I filtered out things such as the Marvel Masterworks, figuring that's hitting a bit of a different audience. And I also filtered out things like the Epic Collection. Okay, because I think those two things are, they have followers in and of themselves for those two lines. If you go down to rank 101, we actually have Iron Man Epic Collection Return of the Ghost, having done 972 units. And then I think we only have one other Iron Man trade on here at rank 157 by Fraction and LaRocca, their complete run, I believe, at rank, 157, having done 693 units. I think that's all the Iron Man we had on the list this time. So if you take what I would consider a high-profile Marvel character and go on the theory, well, you know, you put it out there and the trades will just keep selling over time. There are dozens of trades to have been able to place on the list. And at this point, because again, I was excluding the Epic, one did.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right that it's very hard to make comparisons between the creator-owned and the corporate comics, because I think you know, Marvel and DC, it's almost like its own complete separate, I mean, obviously, you know, superhero comics, it's its own genre, but it's almost like its own separate complete universe. So like, for instance, you know how like you grew up reading a certain age of the comics or the heroes, you know, people talk about the Bronze Age, the Gold Age, the Silver Age, things like that. And what people grew up in is what they get comfortable in and what they expect and what they like. That's their comics for their generation or what they're used to. Those are my, you know, that's, you know, I've heard repeatedly you talk in your weekly reviews about how certain takes on characters are not working with you because you don't agree or don't feel that the characterization is what you would expect for that character.
Mm-hmm, and absolutely. I think
along those same lines, each generation of comic readers kind of comes up in a certain style and way of storytelling. Like when I try to read Stan Lee and Jack Kirby stories from the 60s, I completely understand the storytelling in terms of the quality of the art and everything. Like I've come to understand that that is great, but I find those comics somewhat boring, overwrote, and I find I honestly can't read most of them, but I don't think that they're bad comics. I just think that I was introduced to comics in a very different environment. You know, a lot of times people talked about post-Watchmen, pre-Watchmen, the way comics are written, you know, things like that. And I think that that contributes a lot on the superhero side to what era you're in means what you're comfortable reading or what era you came from. And so I think that's what a lot of people don't go back. And to your point, they put out so much material and they reboot so much and they don't give readers clear and easy on-ramps. You know, we've talked about that in the past in terms of trade dress, volume one of their 1300 volume ones of yeah. Iron Man, right? So it's very difficult for someone who, if they wanted to start at the very beginning and read the entire, you know, material, it doesn't lend itself to that. Also, the style of comic writing and art changes every 10 to 15 years. And so people get comfortable with that and then they stick with it. So I think that's why you also don't see a lot of people chasing down stuff that's available and there's just too much available. So. And the other aspect of it is comics is a relative niche. So the sales are never going to be astronomical. You know, obviously we did have a period, you know, the inflated 90s, but I don't know. I think superhero comics are almost kind of in a lot of ways, you know, the disposable entertainment. Do you know what I mean?
And well, they certainly started out that way.
Yeah.
You know, you spend your quarter, your 35 cents, your 60 cents, whatever, you read it, and it's not like it was a big investment, so it's not like you had to, you know, mm-hmm. enshrine it and protect it for the ages. Now, when you're paying $3.99, $4.99, $5.99, you're going to take better care of that because you spent a lot more on it. So I do think that's an aspect of it. And going to your point of the number of volume ones, I was just doing a quick count on the results that I had on the Iron Man stuff, and there was at least a half a dozen number ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of that was, you know, Invincible versus Iron Man versus International Iron Man versus Superior Iron Man versus, you know, Infamous Iron Man versus Hero Reborn Iron Man. But it's one of those things that it's a little ludicrous. It's yeah. a lot ludicrous.
And then that's not even counting like miniseries, and obviously like you'd see more miniseries with like C and D level characters, you know, but you know, you just have. I just think that, and we, you know, what first started this thing off is the economics drive a lot of the actions, and sometimes what we see and consider is short-term gains instead of long-term thinking. And especially at Marvel and DC, I think especially at Marvel, they've come to the understanding that as long as we continue to turn these stories over, people will buy them. Yes, there'll be people grumbling about them, and there'll be people, but. You know, we talk consistently about, well, when are they going to have to pay the price for these things? And so far they haven't, you know, outside of, you know, in the 90s when they had the crash. But that was kind of a lot of other things going on, too. So, you know, maybe that's what the market is that people have come to accept that this is what you're going to get. And so there is no more loyalty to those, you know, 100 to 300 issue runs, you know. You know, I've listened to a number of podcasts where people talk about having uninterrupted runs of Superman, Amazing Spider-Man or Batman, and they've given up on that because there's just too many series and too many switches, and then they don't like a writer for 20 issues and they stop, and, you know, it just kind of breaks the habit.
Yeah, well, and breaking the habit is such a dangerous thing for these publishers to do, mm-hmm. and they don't seem to really factor that in or respect that. it boggles my mind that that's the case, because from a strictly pragmatic business point of view, if you've got an audience that's willing to come back on a regular basis and hand you money if you keep doing decently, the last thing you want to do is interrupt that flow of money.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they seem to do that repeatedly by restarting titles, again, to the point where these trades have so many volume ones even, or can rarely last multiple times, multiple volumes or whatever. It just seems so, not just short-sighted, but bad business.
Oh, and you know, I'm not in the business field, but I've read enough business articles or business books, and one of the most important known quantities that people talk about a business is it is far more expensive to acquire a new customer in terms of marketing and all that than it is to keep an existing customer.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, the expense of keeping an existing customer is minuscule. So that's why you see so many, when companies go to the market and report their performance, they talk about churn a lot, because churn is basically, especially for subscription services like Netflix, they talk about how many customers are going off and coming on, and they talk about acquisition costs per a customer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always loads more expensive to acquire a new customer than it is to keep an existing one. And so you're right. A lot of these things that they do, they think, oh, well, our average sale keeps dropping below this set number we have, so we'll just relaunch. And what they didn't understand, or they understood, maybe just decided they would accept it because their bonuses were dependent on hitting their quarterly numbers and they didn't care, was that every time you start a new number one and you only go 6 issues or 12 issues before you restart over, you give people the opportunity to realize that, hey, I could just come back in a few months if I don't like this, so I'm going to give up, you know? And that's the reality they're now dealing with, shorter and shorter windows, shorter and shorter windows. People so much easier get on and off titles. I mean, look at you. You used to read almost everything, and it got to a point that you were just, you know what? I'm just going to read what I want to read, and the rest can fall to the side. And realistically, John, have you really suffered because of it? No, haven't.
Not at all.
Exactly. See, but look, you were reading for 30 plus years before you got to that, and they successfully cracked it, right?
Well, yeah, and it's something that, you know, when I'm going through the order forms every month, and I was doing that just yesterday for the current one, it's one of those things that I'm looking at a year and a half ago, I would have ordered at least twice what I'm ordering now, guaranteed, probably closer to 3 times.
Yeah, and that's exactly how a lot of these books. Now, obviously, you're a special case in terms of the volume you order at. But when someone does that, when they go from spending, let's just say, $100 a month to $50 a month, then, and you wonder why Marvel used to have titles that sold 50,000 and now they sell 20,000, or they used to sell 20,000 and now they have 10. You know, it's a cumulative effect.
Or whatever would be the inverse of cumulative, because it's not accumulating the way it used to. But that's your point. Yeah.
Attrition, cumulative attrition. Let's put
Yeah. Well, and one of the phrases I used a lot early on to, and I think it stuck in a lot of people's mind, was standard attrition.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started doing these episodes, because it was a standard thing for sales to drop, you know, at least 2-3% on the comic side and stuff like that, just as if it were a force of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be. But it was, and it still is. And I think if anything, it's we've fallen into a bit of a gravity well, and it's accelerated. Because we've got, again, the two items we've really talked about of Walking Dead and Detective Comics, top of the list. Walking Dead, I think we can agree, is a bit of an anomaly. It's a unique case in terms of just how well it does.
Mm-hmm.
Be nice to have other ones like that. There are a few, Saga, etc., but by and large, not many.
Yeah.
80 years of Batman for Detective Comics. Okay, that's a once in an 80-year kind of a book per title. And DC's hit it for the two books they've had going that long.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what would be the next book they would have that could do that. Because they've long stopped running, you know, Adventure Comics and all of the other kind of titles like that. Sensation Comics, etc. So it's not like there's one waiting in the wings for Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
But then the next two items we've got on the list are reorder activity of the first volume of Saga and Monstrous. And we're already at this point with Monstrous below 5,000 units. Again, figure 2,000-3,000 stores out there. Virtually, you know, the overwhelming majority of the list, anything certainly below the top 20, most stores maybe are getting a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if it was that theory of, well, you know, put it in trade and it'll just keep selling, these not even these mid-list Marvel DC books, but these anchor Marvel and DC books, they hit the trade, they show up the one time, and maybe they show up a few other times, but it's like you can only skip a stone so many times across the water or whatever. You only get so much kind of noticeable reorder activity. Now, granted, that's what's making the top 300. If I had the full list over time, I'm sure these Iron Man trades and everything else are showing up a lot more just at smaller and smaller levels than I can see.
Mm-hmm.
But there comes a point, if that's the case, how much does that matter?
Yeah. Well, especially considering there's real cost with warehousing all this, and every year they have more material to warehouse.
Well, either you warehouse it or you reprint it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked before about how I think both of us, and I'm sure many of the listeners, there's that one trade or hardcover they want to get, and if they would just reprint it, we'd be set.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's not quite enough demand. They never make it that far in the series of volumes. They never go back and reprint just in general, whatever. It's a problem a publisher has as they get larger and larger.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be interesting to see how like the new publisher TKO will handle that moving forward, because their idea is to basically just keep everything in print all the time. Well, you start mm-hmm. with four titles. That's very doable.
Mm-hmm.
Do another round of four titles. You have eight titles. That's doable. When you get to the point where you have, say, you know, I don't know, 40 titles, can you keep them all in print?
Yeah, exactly. And then if you're only selling a couple, you know, a couple trades a month, is it worth having that take up your inventory space and, you know, all that stuff?
There's can you and should you?
Well, yeah, there's that. And then also, depending on where their warehouse is, could be expensive. If it's in San Francisco, it's expensive. If it's in Iowa, maybe they can go longer without having to worry about that, you know?
Yeah. And is it something where at some point you open up a warehouse in a low rent area of the country for that purpose?
Yeah. Well, there you go. And then and now you're in almost Amazon's business model, right? So,
but if it works, if you can keep all your material out there,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how easy or hard it may be, say, to get back trades of like Valiant material.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see where if it is hard, it would behoove Valiant to keep that stuff in print and in publication. Now, I suspect they do. They seem pretty savvy in that respect. And I'm trying to think of what would be another good example publisher kind of that size with enough of a back library to keep everything in print because they need that momentum moving forward to support their material.
You know, I think around the same size, I mean, maybe a little bit bigger, depending, although they've cut down some lately, is Oni Press. You know, kind of the one or two steps below Boom kind of thing.
I think for me, the difference between like an Oni and a Valiant is Valiant's got the shared universe.
Yeah, that's true.
And Oni, it's now you've just got the individual title. So I think it's a different mindset at that point.
That is true, especially with a shared universe. If someone wants to explore it, but they can't because some of the titles are out of print, especially some of those Valiant lately has done that thing where they'll cross stories over through the various books. So if, you know, you're going back, obviously digital is an option, but we've talked in the past how I really think that readers are very segmented. Like sometimes a digital reader has no interest in print and print readers have no interest in digital.
I think that's definitely true. And I think that's kind of a good thing in some respects. I mean, imagine if there wasn't that sort of de facto delineation, and by which we don't mean that everyone who reads digital has no interest in print, but the majority of people who read digital want digital, not print.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's blurs at the boundaries. But yeah. If that weren't the case, when digital came along, it could have absolutely cratered the print market.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Especially, yeah.
So that would have been a very bad thing in general, because I think the print market is, I mean, it's not like, you know, on its last legs necessarily, but it's not as strong as it could be and as, you know, frankly, I think it should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in this point where there is such a huge interest in the material that is published in these comics. So many things have been licensed and become movies, television shows, Netflix shows, what have you, that there really ought to be a little bit more trickle down from there to the source material. Just like how when a movie comes out and it's based on a book, you would see an uptick in the sale of the book. Mm-hmm. We just generally don't see that in stuff on the comic and trade side. Yet there's I think, no logical reason for that to be the case.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I want to jump down to two items in the top 10, ranks 8 and 10, because I think they're kind of interesting. We mentioned it briefly, the Super Sons, the Polar Shield project from DC Zoom. It's trade paperback. 3,798 units, ranked number 8, and then at ranked number 10, Mira Tidebreaker, this from DC Inc., 3,651 units. These are two of the initial projects, in one case for DC Zoom, the other for DC Inc., that are reaching out towards younger readers. So I think it's good they did well here on the Diamond list. I think these are the sorts of things that hopefully are going through channels like Scholastic and libraries and such and doing well there too.
No, absolutely. So I was excited to see this on there as well. And this was a kind of OGN, right? Like it was just released as a completed format, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was actually got a big push in my library, both in the printed form as well as on the Hoopla digital app. It was front and center. They have a almost iTunes-like carousel. You know, when you're shopping in iTunes, they, you know, slowly will rotate books through on like a carousel thing in front of you. And those books, obviously, you know, that's a big form of marketing. And this was one of the titles that was on the front page of the Hoopla app at my library. So it's a big push, I think. And obviously, you know, the material, you know, a lot of times they market that digital stuff, at least at my library, to the teens and kids. And so I think that this is going to be a successful thing for them.
I hope so, because the Super Sons one in particular was billed as the first in an epic three-part series that follows, you know, the Sons of Superman and Batman and such. So obviously, I mean, they're trying to get this property out there to that age range, which I think is a smart move. What I found interesting is this is kind of sort of almost the manga mentality of do a larger chunk a little less frequently. For that age group, or just for any age group, really. Mm-hmm. What I thought was maybe not as wise of a decision is this seems to be almost a different take on these characters. They're a little bit older, not much. Damian in particular is older, and I think he was going by Ian in this series. I could be wrong. And they've added some other female character, Candace, of, you know, who is she? It's like, well, I don't know. I haven't read the thing. So I think if people were to read this and then try to get transitioned to, say, Super Sons or Adventures of the Super Sons, would it work? Is it close enough to the same characters or not? I'm not sure. So I'm curious how that goes. And if this is a success, is there something after those three volumes? Because they've also done, in addition to the Mirror one, a Catwoman one, which I think is one of the things they'd kind of done a tease for in the Free Comic Book Day material.
Mm-hmm. Well, and interestingly enough is the Super Sons a digest and like a little bit shorter? Because I'm interested with the pricing difference compared to the Mara. I mean, is it maybe like 96 page digest size, and then the Mara is more of like 160 full size? Because that price difference pretty significant there.
I'm not sure, but I think so. It doesn't say here in the solicit, and I don't remember.
Yeah, because the Super Sons is $9.99, and the Mara one is $16.99. So I would just be interested to see if they're also, while they're testing out this in the direct market, obviously these price points are similar in the Amazon or bookstore market. So I'm wondering if they're also seeing a little bit of like what works best in this as they approach a new market.
Yeah, I think the Mirror one was more of a done-in-one.
Okay.
Than the Super Sons.
Like GN kind of thing. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So maybe if there's three of these Super Sons, then it's nine, you know, and it obviously would add up to more than the total. Like, let's say the Mirror one is like 160 pages. But this one, if you collected the Super Sons all together, it's like 240 or something, you know, and these are little like 96 to 120 page ones. So that makes sense.
I wish they included the story page count in the solicit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's in that. I mean, obviously you get a certain amount of metadata. They usually include that in the actual previews on the page, but, you know, you get what you get from a Diamond, right?
Yeah, but I've got one other place I can go look for that. If you give me a second to query my database real quick. Yeah. Because maybe it is hidden in there. But I think reaching out to these younger readers is a smart move.
Oh, absolutely. I think that as, you know, it's interesting. You know, I'm going to make a comment, and, you know, I'm sure some of our listeners will, you know, get their backs up, because the reality is I think the people that listen to our podcast are relative, you know, not super comic fans, but, you know, they're comic fans in the traditional sense. And I think that in my opinion, what I see a lot of the companies doing is saying that we are unable or don't have the money to do it at scale that we would need to successfully grow the direct market. So we are going to turn our attention to what we think we can with the resources we have, and that's outside the direct market. So that's the library market, the book market through Scholastic, the book, you know, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, those other things, do a lot more social media stuff, you know, just basically people, you know, 14-year-old girls, you know, 25-year-old women, people that we don't quote-unquote commonly think of as comic readers. But obviously, comics is a very generalized term and can mean anything, especially in this day and age when web comics are so popular. So I think that a lot of when these companies do things like this, that's somewhat of an acknowledgement of this is where we're going to put our efforts, because in some extents, our efforts have not been successful in the direct market.
Yeah, I think there's an aspect of certain properties are going to be successful with different audiences, and the direct market is a particular audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they should, you know, put all their eggs in one basket. And I think, like with DC Zoom, which is targeting an 8 to 12 age range, DC Inc., 13 and up, trying to tell stories that are kind of an on-ramp for younger readers, getting them in there, transitioning them through maybe DC Inc. into the mainstream DC books, I think is a smart move. It's a long-term strategy. The Mirror Tidebreaker one, by the way, is 192 pages, and the Super Sons is 160 pages.
Oh, wow. That's more than I would have thought for that. Okay.
So not that big of a difference in page count or whatever. And it's for Super Sons, a 5.5x8 and a 6x9 format for Mira Tidebreaker. So physically, they're slightly different sizes.
They're about the same size. So then it probably is that like one and done story aspect of the Mira. So they have to kind of make the money on that because they don't have a follow up to it. It's interesting because usually your manga page counts for a volume is going to be anywhere from about 220 to 250 per volume.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. Obviously, like if they have a 3-part series here, and there may be more pages in the later ones, but just an interesting side note to see what their kind of average page counts are going to keep it at.
Well, let's take that Mirror one at 192 pages and say, well, you know, if it were a 6-issue mini series, that'd be about 20 pages a piece, 180 pages. Add in either a chapter break or a little back matter, front matter, yeah. Whatever.
Intro pages, all that.
Yeah, you quickly get to 192 or whatever. Whereas the Super Sons is really the equivalent of not quite a 4-issue miniseries or whatever. That one's going to be interesting to see how they do the pacing on it.
Mm-hmm.
And how big of a deal this other character ends up being or not. But again, I think aiming towards different age groups, trying to create an on-ramp into the comic hobby to take the place of the old spinner racks or Saturday morning cartoons is a good idea, because frankly, we've proven, I think, that the movies and TV shows, while they get people interested in the properties, people see that as enough in and of itself to not venture into the comics.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I get it. You know, for the longest time, I was happy reading the Star Trek or watching the Star Trek TV shows before even venturing to read any of the novels.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a question of, in that case, the TV show was the originating format, whereas here the comics are the originating format. To most people, I really don't think they care.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's an aspect of there are many forms of entertainment, and some people are completely satisfied with just watching, you know, the TV or movie version and then moving on to other things. And some people really have their other niches. Some people go all the way in on something. Some people just like to read the book version. They never want to see the movie, and vice versa, you know?
Yeah. Well, and we've talked many times about how our culture is just not that much of a reading culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's becoming more and more of an issue. And I think that's why slowly sales are deteriorating just in general.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that those two properties came out and were in the top 10 in the direct market, I do think is a good thing.
Absolutely. Well, and I think that stores also realizing in the direct market that, you know, what do we hear when we talk to retailers about what's growing? You know, I've been listening to your the retailer spotlight on Cowabunga Comics, and you know, I've listened to other podcasts where they talk to retailers, and they say they, you know, the kids and teen section is where they're putting a lot of their effort because that's where the sales growth is. Mm-hmm. So obviously the retailers in the know are going to be ordering these books because they know that they're marketed to them. It's going to be easier for them to push those, and obviously, you know, hopefully there's a continuation of more new material, continuation of support from the publisher, and, you know, just kind of like from what I understand, the retailers will take all the help they can get in terms of getting people to buy their books, you know. So,
well, and that's just a long-term good strategy for a comic shop,
mm-hmm.
because those younger readers are, frankly, they're going to be around a lot longer. I mean, certainly don't do it to the exclusion of the older readers, because I fall into that category. We tend to have a little bit more discretionary income to spend on this stuff. But there does come a point where all of us kick the bucket. Now, there'll come a point where the younger ones do too, but it's a lot further away. So I think any way you can grow both your readership, your customer base, but more importantly, your demographic, I think that's a smart move.
Mm-hmm.
Because different things will sell to different people, and if one category of either material or readers cools off, having others you can rely on is just smart business.
Oh, absolutely.
So what else looked interesting to you on the list?
I was encouraged to see at rank number 19, Mr. Miracle, seeing some reorder activity, and pretty solid reorder activity. You know, when you see the reorder activity in the thousands, that's pretty good. It means there's probably been some good sell through. And that's the first month of reorder activity. So I like to see that. I, of course, waited for that when they did solicit the hardcover. So I'll be getting that in that way. But I like to see, I'm a fan of Tom King work, Tom King's 12 issue maxi series. He kind of has made a name doing those on the side when he's, you know, not doing Batman or whatnot. And I like the way he writes that stuff. And I like that kind of like a beginning, middle, and an end story that, you know, isn't 100 issue Batman run. I know you have an issue with that current situation, but I do like his other work in that respect.
I was going to say, I'm kind of a fan of him not doing Batman, but I don't think that was the question you were asking.
yeah, for sure. You know, I think that one of the things is that is successful right now is strong voices in comics. And I think, you know, a couple months ago or maybe a year ago, we were having a conversation about Marvel saying, well, we can't, artists don't sell books anymore and things like that. And so I just am encouraged when I see that creators can still stand out. And, you know, maybe it's not necessarily easy and it's hard, but there are still opportunities for people to create work that I think will stand the test of time. Do I think anything that Tom King has done is on a level of Watchmen? No, but I'm just saying that, you know, there's so much Marvel and DC that I think is ephemeral and almost worth forgetting. And it's nice to see certain things that I think will stick around.
Well, I think another example of that kind of thing is it ranked 47 on the list with Batman White Knight.
Mm-hmm.
That was Sean Murphy, I believe it was. And it did well enough that he's doing another series.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, strong creative voice there. He did both the writing and the art. Certainly that helps the cohesiveness of the story. But it did well, got good reader reaction. And, again, they're going to do a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one that we have reorder activity this time on the list of 1,648 units. And it's been on the list 5 times before.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, in all honesty, I'm sure that DC keeps track of that type of stuff before they greenlight the follow up. Right. They say, oh, this has got some legs. There's a strong contingent. And, you know, considering the type of marketing budgets these companies put into this, especially stuff that's already been out, if they see things get reordered consistently, they know that there's demand. You know what I mean? So it's almost like that's our measurement of success. Therefore, we can go forward with the follow up. You know, the return on investment for when they market and push stuff is just so low. I think that this is how they decide to continue with stuff. Well, is it selling? Okay, keep doing it. Which, well, you talked about in the past with Spider-Man during the Clone Saga, that can be their detriment too. But
yeah, but I think DC's got a long history of paying attention to the numbers, mm-hmm. understanding them, and knowing when to follow them and when kind of not to.
Yeah, and unlike Marvel, they wouldn't put out 14 versions of the White Knight. At least that's what we hope. You know, they wouldn't have six ongoing Spider-Mans at the same time. So
I think there's always been an aspect of DC's leadership that's a bit more pragmatic about that and knowing that you can kill the golden goose if you're not careful.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a lot of that for the longest time was Bob Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one who would do that kind of assessment of the numbers and maybe not necessarily make the final decisions, but certainly coach the people who did, Paul Levitz, etc., mm-hmm. on, you know, what he thought and why. And frankly, I'm surprised Bob Wayne hasn't popped up at some other publisher by now.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of knowledge about the industry and stuff locked in his brain that some of these other publishers could really leverage, I think, to good effect. I'm trying mm-hmm. to think where it would be kind of maybe not the best, but maybe at least the most interesting place for him to show up. But certainly at either a Boom, a Valiant, one of those kind of middle tier publishers that have a decent library that he could help, you know, channel into stronger sales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, and in all fairness to as devil's advocate, you know, if you're a Marvel zombie, you might argue, well, DC does publish dozens of Batmans. You know, they just do it in slightly different way. That's not always ongoing, and they have kind of like stories that aren't necessarily connected, and they're, you know, generally 4 to 6 issue miniseries and things like that, exactly like the Batman White Knight. So they do publish a lot of Batman.
They do publish a lot of Batman, but I think the way they do it and the way Marvel does it is fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's significant differences in character between Nightwing, Robin, Batman, Batwing, all of which at one point I think had concurrent titles.
Mm-hmm.
Versus Spider-Man, Peter Parker Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2099, Spectacular. I mean, it got to where, you know, you couldn't tell which Spider-Man was which. And it frankly got to a confusing point.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the number of X titles at any one point. Yeah, there are multiple, you know, Justice League titles. So it's not that DC doesn't do some of those things, but they do it to a lesser degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that makes it not as bad. I don't know.
Yeah, and I agree with you in terms of like there's definitely more segmentation in the Batman world where you kind of there's basically Batman and then Detective if you wanted to follow the series ongoing, and then everything else is kind of a you know the universe that isn't always published consistently. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and at one point, you know, they would differentiate the Superman and action titles based on the sorts of stories they would tell there. Whereas I never felt it was quite that way with the Spider-Man titles.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, other than which mutant showed up in which, I could not tell you if there was a thematic difference between any of the X-Men titles.
Yeah, that's a very good point. The X-Men stuff, wow, there's so many so many versions.
Even the Avengers at times.
Yeah.
You know, what makes that more mighty than the other or something, or more uncanny or more savage? Okay, savage, I get. That one's just whatever.
You know, that brings up an interesting point. Do you think it is the fact that realistically, what Marvel actually has is they have a group of fans that are fans of the Avengers, group of fans that are, you know, for each of the main, like, an X-Men, Avengers, Spider-Man, you know, and then, but they just don't trust themselves with only having one or two series because they just have to have hit their numbers. So they just can't help themselves but publish 6 or 7 books in each line. And then it just does over and over and over again. People just get burned out and it's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know what they're thinking at times at at Marvel with some of this. Certainly some of it is we're going to toss this out for a 6-issue run knowing it's not going to last any longer. We're not going to say it's a miniseries, but it is. And just maybe there's interest in New Mutants, maybe there's not. And mm-hmm. in fairness, DC has absolutely done that when they did Arkham Manor, I think it was, and a couple of other things that seemed very clearly intended to last 6 issues to get them from point A to point B and then chuck it all and forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I would argue if you were to mention Arkham Manor to anybody, most of them would have pretty much forgotten about it until the mention of the title, and even then they may not be able to tell you what it was and if it has any bearing on current continuity.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, to me, that's almost the addictive nature of the shared universe for the publisher. We've got it. We've got to keep feeding the beast. You know, keep putting things out there to maintain at least the illusion of a shared universe, even if at times it seems clear that the publishers and the creators almost seem to despise the concept. Others seem to love it, which is good. Others seem to leverage it well, too. I think Bendis is doing some fun stuff with that over at DC.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of creators, man, if they could just chuck the entire shared universe and continuity aspect of comics at DC and Marvel, they'd like to.
Gotcha.
I could be a mistake, but I think they'd do it. one of the other things that's interesting, a little lower at the list, rank 65, is Cloak and Dagger Negative Exposure. This is one of the many, I guess, mass market graphic novels they've done that was originally in digital, and this is first time in print.
Oh, interesting.
1,326 units. Pretty sure I picked this one up. I'd have to go look at my ever-growing stack of unread trades,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty sizable.
Well, now once you get caught up with your reading, maybe you can have an episode devoted to like a random trade you pick off the pile. You just stick your hand in there and you pull one out and say, all right, we'll see what this is.
I might do that because I am current on my reading.
There you go.
You're at least an episode behind on the Weekly Comic Spotlight, I think.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think I'm right now. I'm finishing up listening to the Cowabunga one, and then there's one Weekly Comic Spotlight after that, which I'm sure I'll hear about you catching up. That's good though.
Yeah.
See? Now you can read all the other comics you're behind on, right?
Well, I'm actually using the time to do a few other projects, but yeah, the idea is to start chipping away at some of this other stuff. It's just there's so much material.
Yes, there is. At rank 71, I wanted to highlight the, I don't read this material, but I know that you've spoken about it, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Volume 7. And anytime you can get to Volume 7, even in licensed material, I think that shows that there is a decent market for this, right? Like they're being successful. And I know you've talked in the past about the material being good and that you've been impressed with how they've been pushing the story forward, and they've been doing a better job than, you know, sometimes we worry with licensed material. Are they just going to, you know, throw this out there and milk the fan base? But you said that they've been making good stories as well.
Boom made the right decision in who they had do the book with Kyle Higgins.
Mm-hmm.
This particular trade is collecting issues 25 to 28 of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. This is really when Shattered Grid was going full swing and just he was knocking it out of the park, clear home run on this, and just did a terrific job expanding from just the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers to many of the other teams and kind of opening up that that universe. Imagine if you'd been reading, not say the Justice League, but the Justice Society as a standalone thing, and then in comes this Justice League and it opens them up to the whole multiverse. It was almost that kind of a moment for the comic.
Gotcha.
Obviously, as a reader, if you were reading it, you were aware of Power Rangers. You knew there had been multiple seasons and all of this. But the way they just folded that in and embraced the mythos so well, while tweaking in a few places where needed, was just brilliant. Mm-hmm. Kyle Higgins was at the recent Power Morphicon Express that I went to, and he was asked if he'd be willing to go back to the comic. And he, you know, paused for a moment and stuff of kind of, well, how do I answer this diplomatically, I think was what he might have been thinking. I don't know what he was really thinking, though. And he's like, no, his attitude was he'd gone, he'd done what he set out to do. He ended on a high note. And frankly, it felt like he didn't think he could go back and do as well or better than he had already done.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, on the one hand, I'd love to see him try, but on the other hand, I hate to see him fail.
Yeah, that's true.
He did just, again, such a terrific job on that. It was very much what a Crisis on Infinite Earths sort of story would have been like in the Power Ranger franchise, in all of the right ways.
Gotcha.
And it's something that they've, I think, had him do the writing on whatever the current Power Ranger video game is, Battle for the Grid or something like that, which is very much leveraging the same villain of Lord Drakon and the same thematic storyline.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely one I recommend. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And it really showed how Power Rangers, while a superhero property, is a little bit different of a superhero property than standard, just because, again, its genesis was TV, and that's genesis was Japanese TV, and ironically, that's genesis was Marvel Comics in some way, shape, or form. Because all of the Sentai stuff really kind of was a joint project between some of it early on, Toei and Marvel. It was literally right around the time they did the Japanese Spider-Man TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just there's certainly aspect of American comics baked into the premise, but through a very different lens than to have that, again, reworked in from Super Sentai to Power Rangers and whatnot, and then have that all reworked into comics, I find just kind of fascinating and happy that Boom's having quite a bit of success with it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And even happier that Hasbro doesn't seem to be making any moves to rock the boat on that.
Yeah, that's always good to see when the licensee gives them creative freedom, you know, for the most part.
Well, not just creative freedom in partnership and stuff, because certainly Saban and Bandai had partnered very well with Boom Studios, and that seems to be holding true with Hasbro. But all the other Hasbro properties are over at IDW.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they're not saying, well, let's just move it over there and be done with it, I think that'd be a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
There's something working right now over on the Power Rangers stuff at Boom between Mighty Morphin and Go-Go that it's not broken, don't fix it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, but definitely enjoying it, definitely recommend that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the items a little lower on the list at rank 82 is one that I'm pretty sure Sam's been getting. I don't know if this exact one or others, but it's New Teen Titans. In this case, it's Volume 10 trade paperback, 1,144 units. This is, of course, collecting the classic Wolfman Perez run. In this case, it's the New Teen Titans 10 to 15 and annual number one. I'm pretty sure that's from the Baxter series, not the original New Teen Titans.
Gotcha.
Matter of fact, yeah. I'm almost certain of that.
I have not read that material. I've heard such great things about it, but it was just from an era before I started reading comics. So,
highly recommend it. Start at the beginning. It. Mm-hmm. You were talking about how earlier, you know, whatever, wherever you start, that's kind of your golden age of comics. This was kind of mine.
Gotcha.
It took me a year or two to get into New Teen Titans, but I remember when it was sitting there on the rack, it was right around mm-hmm. the time of All-Star Squadron and some other stuff, and really DC was just doing some great stories at the time.
Oh, for sure. And one of the points I wanted to make with that earlier was that usually you can go, like, if you like whatever era you start in, you can go 10 years in the past or 10 years in the future and usually not be totally thrown out of stories. It's when you have 20, 30 years before or, you know, after what your sweet spot is, that a lot of times just the way that storytelling is then, it's tough. It's tough to get used to.
Oh, absolutely. There is a world of difference between today's storytelling. Certainly I would say 90s storytelling. I would say between 90s and 80s, absolutely. And certainly mm-hmm. you go back to like the 60s, it's a different mindset. And geez, you go back to the 40s or 50s.
Yeah, very different.
Yeah, and I don't mean to imply in a bad way in either direction, but just so radically different if you're used to one that any other style can be just jarring.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about it in other forms like of entertainment, like music. You know, the music my dad listened to is very different than the music I listened to. And his mother's music is very different. You know, the music of the 20s and 30s is very different than the music that he listened to. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. At one point in, I think it was the 70s, there were some hardcovers that came out for like Shazam, Superman, and I think Batman from like the 30s to the 70s or 30s to the 80s, whatever it was. And they just had selected stories, much like the Detective Comics 80 Years of Batman and the Action Comics one.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go through that and you get a cross-section of material from different decades, you can really see how the expectations on art changed mm-hmm. dramatically over the years and the storytelling style.
Yeah, pacing and storytelling, yeah.
Well, pacing in particular, man, you look at some of those stories like in the 50s and it's almost like a slideshow. Where, yeah, Superman goes to another planet. That's one scene. The next panel is he goes and saves today. The next panel, well, there was an asteroid storm he deals with or whatever. And uh-huh. you're getting like a panel per scene versus, you know, you go to the decompressed era, which hopefully I think we're a little bit past, not totally past. And it's just so, you know, things that would literally take a panel there, they'll do, you know, six issues on now.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it's figuring out what is your storytelling, you know, reading sensibility or whatever versus what they're doing, I think is important.
Absolutely.
But I think that's also why typically what we see on the list here is a lot more modern and current stuff going back 15, maybe 20 years, or it is isolated classics or selected reprints, either of a Marvel masterwork or something of Golden Age material or something like that, but that's more the exception than the rule. Because I think that just plays to a different audience.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I definitely, looking at rank number 58, it definitely looks like there was some sort of extra discounting Image was doing for their, at least their volume ones in the series. Because you see, you know, the retail rank for that is 241. And I don't know if maybe there was extra discounting depending on the individual series, maybe those creators said, hey, yeah, you can give them extra off so that way you can get it into the channel. I'm not sure, but that book, Kill or Be Killed by Brubaker, definitely has had good reorder activity. This is the 26th time it's been reordered. So, you know, but that does look like what has happened. A lot of this reorder activity looks like to have been discounted.
I would agree with that. And just going through the list a bit more, I think it's across a lot of creators at Image. I think it was an Image thing in general, because a lot of those are much higher retail ranking than ought to be given where the sales are in the list.
I almost wonder if it's Image's version of clearing out the warehouse, you know, every spring cleaning, quote unquote. You know, we need more room for the next series. Here's a good deal for the retailers, especially on volume ones, to get people potentially checking these series out.
Could be. Either way, it certainly got some sales. And if that sales translates into new readers and that helps them for later volumes and such, that's a win.
Mm-hmm.
How many of these are all first volumes? Go filter the list to Image real quick and take a look at that. I think we're still seeing some... No, many of these are first volumes. I don't know that all of them are.
Mm-hmm.
Let me kind of jump to one specific price point and see if there's some stuff that's... Yeah, certainly not all of them, because if you filter it to the $9.99 price point for just Image, you see that the retail rank continues to increase as you go down the list up until you hit the last two items, and these are at rank 416 and 485, where suddenly it kind of goes back down, and there's also one at 326 that falls out of line there. Mm-hmm. So I think for many of these things, it's, hey, we've got first volumes, let's go push those out at a higher discount. Because when you see things at, you know, a four-digit retail rank and then back down to a two-digit or three-digit retail rank, it's like, yeah, they did some discounting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a bad move. I think it's smart to do that on first volumes. I think it's less of a win to do it on later volumes, just because I think the first one is the main barrier to entry.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many things that can influence how these things sell, both in terms of behind the scenes promotional pushes like that, as well as, you know, what's actually going on in the title, and sometimes what do people think of the title regardless of what was going on in it. So what else looked interesting?
I did notice, where was it? It was the Dark Horse, Frank Miller, the Xerxes.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah. I thought those sales were middling, but I don't know if that's just because he doesn't put out very much material. And so he's almost kind of like the era has passed him by kind of thing. I don't really follow a lot of his stuff. So I just saw that the sales were, I think, like 1600 units. So just not what I would consider. I don't know. He's obviously considered one of the you know, super important creators. I just was surprised that rank 51, and that's the hardcover. It's pretty expensive. Maybe that was part of the reason why it didn't sell as well.
I think it was pretty expensive. Honestly, I wasn't blown away by the comic. I'm trying to remember if this was actually what was, I don't want to say the source material for the other movie, because it came out well after the other movie, but I think it was the same basic story. I don't remember. It's been long enough since the movie came out that any bump they might have been able to get from the movie, I think, was long since gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if it had come out around the time of the movie, if it had come out before the movie as a comic, been collected into this hardcover and stuff around the time the movie came out, it could have done much better.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not the particular target audience for this either, so I got it in the issues, but I'm not a huge Frank Miller fan. I don't like his art style.
Yeah, I mean, I understand, like, the... his, you know, the stuff that he kind of made his name on in the past, but I think I've not been incredibly drawn to his newer material. It wasn't something that I was interested in. I always kind of like seeing, you know, how certain things do from the quote unquote legends from the past, because when we talk about people getting into comics at a certain time and they kind of, that's what they're interested, you kind of see how, you know, different eras have different, creators that are kind of like the focus. And that eventually everyone gets kind of passed by, like, you know, Stan Lee eventually isn't writing comics anymore, and eventually Bendis won't be writing comics anymore. And you know, eventually there'll be new creators that kind of like take up the zeitgeist. And it's just interesting tracking those different different trends.
I wish there was some way to literally chart those sort of things, because there are times where you've got creators out there that are still doing work,
mm-hmm.
and it's sometimes great work, but they're not at their height of popularity and sales juice that they were at one point. I mean, Wolfman and Perez were literally, I mean, you could not get any higher of an echelon of creator, particularly at DC at the time in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been doing work, you know, lesser degree more recently and stuff, but still recent work that didn't get, you know, quite the buzz because a lot of younger readers, it's like, well, who is this Marv Wolfman? I've never heard of him, you know, sort of thing. I get mm-hmm. it, but kind of I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if people don't always know enough about the history of the medium and know who some of the greats are.
Oh, absolutely. I think that you see that all the time, people not knowing kind of like what inspired styles, what, you know, things like that.
Well, it's funny because one of the comments I've gotten with James and also Drew and stuff on the Weekly Comic Spotlight once in a while is just kind of the assumption that this character is brand new and what a great creation they were or whatever. I'm like, yeah, the character's been around 30 years because they had no way of knowing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and especially nowadays, you just can't read everything that's coming out. So imagine someone who's just getting into comics now, it would, you know, craziness.
And literally, there is no way to know other than to be told if it's a new character or not.
Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, with Wikipedia and the, you know, the comic database and all that, but that takes an extra level of wanting to find out and research and, you know what I mean?
Well, that's if the question comes up to you, is it a new character or not, when it's just they showed up in the comic, I'd never seen them before.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, there are ways to answer the question if you think to ask it.
Mm-hmm.
But it'd be like, I don't know, it's every once in a while, some artist will remake a song from, you know, 30 years back or whatever, and sometimes it'll hit bigger than it did back then. Other times, people, it's just a remake, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. And either you know or you don't and stuff. And there's an aspect of that in comics where either they're retelling the same basic story they've told before, or doing a riff on it or whatever, or again, there's a creator somebody doesn't know. It's like, well, how do you not know? A great example of that is Mage. A lot of people for this series that just ended, it's like, hey, what's the big deal? It's just a series by some guy.
Mm-hmm.
It was Matt Wagner. He was a big deal at one point. Mage was a big deal at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Final volume came out, and a lot of people, none the wiser. You know, well, it's interesting.
There's another aspect of continuity of storytelling, right? Like the... You know, he did the first couple series, and then it's been years since he did that one, and falling out of the collective consciousness, right?
Yeah. Well, another great example of that is Section Zero that Carl Kessel and Tom Grummett and stuff are brought back. And then when it goes to the fourth issue, which I did a clip on for the preview spotlight, they've did the first three originally. It was released through Guerrilla Comics. They're re-releasing those. They decided to redo the fourth issue, even though they had some of it done, because the story jumps 18 years, as does the creation time. So you're going to see three issues by the creative team from 18 years ago bounce to the same creative team from now, picking it up, the story 18 years later, as well as, you know, doing it 18 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys, I'm not going to say Carl Kessel was a huge deal at the time, but he was a name, very uh-huh. solid name. And certainly Tom Grummett was a big name artist at the time. You know, now I don't know how many people would currently really recognize them as such. Hopefully many, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think it speaks to that. You know, there's so much going on that you almost have to kind of keep your, you know, in the book world. Especially in the self-publishing realm, they talk about having to release a new book every 3 to 6 months just to stay relevant. Otherwise, people forget about you and move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's really tough to do sequential art. You know, we talk about a monthly schedule and how it's hard for artists to do that nowadays. And there's a few people that still do it, but it's that kind of you have to stay in the mind of your customers. Otherwise, they forget about it and move on to the next shiny object, right?
For the comic and trade realm, how long do you think that memory span is?
You know, that's a very good question, because I think for a lot of stuff, it's almost like the Sturgeon's Law, right? Like 90% of stuff is crap. 90% of the stuff published today in comics is going to be for completely and utterly forgotten. But there are evergreen things. You know, look at how successful Vertigo has been in, at least into the last 5 to 10 years, of keeping a lot of their stuff in print. And whenever people get introduced to comics, you know, when they're adults, they say, oh, go, you can start here. Why the Last Man? You can start here with Sweet Tooth, Scalped, DMZ, Preacher, you know, those kind of comics that are, or Swamps, you know, Saga of the Swamp Thing, things that are relatively evergreens that will continue to sell, you know, those kind of things. But if you say, oh, that's a lot of different titles, but when you add up the hundreds and hundreds of other titles that were published at the same time that are completely forgotten, it's still a drop in the bucket. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's what I'm wondering is how long does something kind of stay in the public consciousness? Because it's easy to forget when certain things came out.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, one of the things you mentioned there mixed in with all the other titles was Sweet Tooth, and that's only about 10 years old, whereas a lot of the other ones you were mentioning go back, I think, another at least 10, 20 years.
Yeah. Scalped is right around Sweet Tooth's time. I think they both finished within a year or two of each other, but yeah.
But when I tend to think Vertigo, I'm tending to think earlier Vertigo, Swamp Thing, Sandman, that kind of stuff.
Blue Bullets, yeah.
So it's I know Drew had mentioned on the Slack channel, you know, didn't they just do a villain thing not that long ago? And it was the villain month in Forever Evil, which was about 5-6 years ago now.
Oh yeah.
And it's one of those things. It does feel like it was both more recent and longer ago. So I totally get where he was coming from, thinking kind of that they had just done it.
Well, and you know, an interesting thought about that is, maybe the you know, at least for Marvel and DC, maybe the companies are like, well, if we do it every 5 to 7 years, you know, some of the stories that are relatively similar, or we do these reboots every 5 to 7 years, or line reboots, you know, people forget about the past one, you know, which is, on one hand, tells you how maybe their storytelling isn't great if it's not memorable, but on the other hand, it just may be the way that the market is.
The funny thing is there's a historic precedent for that, because it used to be that they knew that the readership would roll over every, you know, 4 or 5 years, so they could retell the same stories.
Uh-huh.
And it had got to where there was a long enough memory in the audience that they couldn't do that. And for them now to be able to feel potentially like they can again, man, that seems like a loss.
Definitely different, for sure.
Yeah. Let's see. This time on the list, we hit under 1,000 units just before getting out of the top 100. So there's a lot of stuff on the list that, you know, most stores just aren't getting. And again, a lot of that's going to be, you know, some reorder activity and whatnot. And some of it's just stuff that don't know that there was a huge demand for to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Rank 300, we're down at 312 units. So we got 200 items below that. Which, if you then compare to that top seller of, you know, 11,000 and such, it's, you know, the first few items start to equate to the bottom, you know, below the radar part of the list. I always find that kind of stuff, interesting and almost hilarious in some respect. Just because there's so much stuff out there, but so much of it is going to such a small audience at times.
Mm-hmm.
That, good though it may be, most people are never going to even be aware of it, much less see it or read it.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom of the list, rank 500, we're at 182 units. So just a lot of things in that 200 to 300 range that are selling 200 to 300 units, give or take. Again, ton of reorder activity this time around. Again, not too surprising. That's frankly, I think, a good thing on the trades list. If we look at the price points, $16.99 seemed to be the predominant price point. If we look at $20 and below, that is 71.33% of the top 300 and 72.8% of the top 500.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority of the stuff is still fairly affordable and whatnot. I think if you expand that to, say, $30 and below, you're up to, 83.67% of the top 300, and, 85.6% of the top 500. So we still have some high ticket items of the 75 or above range, but just not too many this time. And that's, again, been kind of commonplace of late, which I think is good. I think there's a need for these kind of coffee table editions, but I think doing them sparingly is a wise move.
Yeah.
We had the Earth-X Trilogy Omnibus Omega or whatever from Marvel at $100, the Thanos War Infinity Origin Omnibus, the Avengers Omnibus, the Savage Sword of Conan Original Marvel Years Omnibus, except for the Conan one, were $100. The Conan one was $125. Batgirl the Bronze Age Omnibus, Volume 2, $99.99. And then the $150 was Volume 3 of the Sandman Omnibus. Also at $125 were the New X-Men Omnibus and the Star Wars by Jason Aaron Omnibus. That Savage Sword of Conan one, 1,959 units. That New X-Men one was the lowest selling at reorder activity of 250 units. So, definite range in price and stuff there. Definite range in sales as well across the board.
Yeah, I think I've just noticed a general trend of Image kind of trending towards the $16.99. I think that's more maybe just, you know, there's been inflation, there's more costs with storage, and I think that's just kind of the new number for a lot of this after first image trades.
Yeah, and I think their practice of doing the first one both at $9.99 and again, as we saw here, sometimes blowing them out cheaper to the retailers is just a wise move because it gets people into the title. And I think Image in particular has shown that you can keep people on those titles for a while if there's decent story.
Mm-hmm.
And then having those next volumes not be, you know, crazy expensive or whatever, I think is good.
Absolutely.
There are times I definitely think Marvel and DC almost price themselves out of the market. I don't think people are wanting to spend $30 or $40 on a trade or a hardcover.
Oh, I definitely agree.
I think it's far too competitive of a market these days to be expecting that.
Mm-hmm.
So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, lists of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or excuse, and items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.